once more under the breech, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dad.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I feel like there's, like, we're muffled or something. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I don't.
No.
Is the microphone turned up?
The microphone is turned up.
Okay.
Mic one is at 7, and we usually put it at 6. I don't know.
Well, we're just muffled.
We're muffled today.
That's because it's coming up on the end of the year.
It's because we're dangerous dogs.
It's because December is moving along very nicely, and it's approaching winter, and we feel muffled. You muffle yourself up.
Right.
In the wintertime. Anyway.
Or maybe it's because we're loud engines.
Could be. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of a radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And we say SEC in front of it because we are registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they are our regulators, but they neither approve or disapprove of anything we say, do, or think.
They will deny us our very existence if it comes down to it.
Well, no, they won't deny our existence. You can go to their website, and it says we're there.
That's true. Until they deny it to us.
Oh,
see,
they could
at any moment.
And let's see what other disclosures we have to do. We advertise on this radio program. No, we don't advertise on this radio. We advertise the radio program on KTEM. We don't get paid by KTEM, but we don't pay KTEM to do this. So we're not paying for this radio program.
Right. But they're not paying us either.
Right. So it's a fair deal, I guess. Nobody pays nobody. That's an interesting concept. Anyway, the information.
Does somebody pay nobody or does nobody pay nobody?
Because you got it. Nobody is paying somebody.
But if nobody pays somebody, somebody doesn't get paid.
Actually,
if nobody
somebody's
pays
paying
nobody,
nobody.
Nobody even began to be paid.
Well, the information we present on this radio program is not investment advice, even though we are part of an investment advisory firm. We do this radio program to present educational information, and the information that we present we have obtained from sources we believe, or should say deem, to be reliable. But we make no guarantee or warranty as to the completeness or accuracy of that information because we didn't go out and get it ourselves. Now, it could be that the Commerce Department and the Labor Department are pulling off a massive conspiracy to fake the numbers, but we don't think so.
No.
But we go get information from there and from the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times and Barron's and places like that, and we report on it. And we generally tell where we got it. Is there something else? Seems like there's something else that I should disclose, but I can't think of what it is.
Educational, not investment advice. You got that. We got closed cover before striking. Yep. Coffee may be hot. Okay. We're not paying for and not being paid. All right.
We're not approved of by the SEC.
Nobody approves or disapproves or, well, I guess there are probably some people that disapprove.
Well, they don't listen.
We're just trying to figure. Yep, I think we got all the fine print. We just magnified the fine print, though. Is that weird?
Yeah, that is. Hey,
we lead with the fine print.
We had a lot of positive economic information this week. Breakthroughs. It's almost like the market had a wish list, four wishes, and they got all four of them. We'll talk about that later. The interesting thing is, at the end of the week, the S&P 500 stock index was up 0.73%. Despite all this wonderful economic news we got this week. And that could be a bit of a conundrum, but the nature of the market is it tends to rise on rumor. And it tends to sell off, if anything, on the news. But in this particular case, it actually eked out a tiny little 0.73% gain for the week. The word on the street, at least according to the Wall Street Journal, was that traders on Wall Street expected a trade deal of some kind. They expected the 15% tariffs that were supposed to go into effect tomorrow were not going to go into effect. They expected that Congress would figure out some way to avoid shutting down the government on December 20th, which is still technically scheduled to do. And they expected a lot of good things to happen, and they all happened.
Which is Kind of a strange occurrence.
But if
when you expect good things to happen and they do, what is Murphy on vacation?
If none of the, if, well, the replacement for NAFTA, USMCA, actually at least conceptually, like the trade deal, there's a conceptual approval. There's a lot of conceptual approvals were announced this week.
Right. Which we've got to.
They haven't
hopefully
voted on them yet.
Well, let's get them finalized, and then I'll be happy. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoyed the show. I was reading your newsletter, and I zeroed in on the next to the last sentence. Are we approaching irrational exuberance? So I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, that would be logically the next
phase. And we really didn't get into irrational exuberance in the parallel period of 1999 to 2000 until really the market right now is technically just barely above where it belongs. And
right.
There's a range, and there's an index of that range, and anything above 0.7, and it's at 0.7123, it's 0.7, no, it's anything above 70, the market is overbought.
Yeah. And let me come at this from a completely different direction, if you will.
70.183 is the place it is on the index.
Okay. Let's come at this from a completely different direction. Let's compare to where we were in 2006 and 7. We can compare to some other times, too, but this will let you see how big a difference we have between the two eras. We're talking about a recession in the future. We're not talking about a great recession in the future. We have not reached irrational exuberance. When we look back at where that term came from, it was originally stated by, I think it was Schiller. Yep, Schiller. And then Greenspan repeated it. So Schiller wrote a book about it, Irrational Exuberance. So Greenspan repeated it, and that's where it became famous. Greenspan was speaking, and he said, we're in irrational exuberance.
But that was in 1994.
Yeah, yeah. So coming forward, there was some irrational exuberance going into 99. There was a big bunch of irrational exuberance in 2006. Let me tell you probably the best place that I can look to see what's going on there. I'm at Fred right now. Fred is the friend of all economists, and most other people have no idea what I'm talking about. The St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank and the rest of the Federal Reserve have a system called Fred for their information. So you can go to fred.stlouisfed.org and look up.
I think it's Federal Reserve Economic Data.
Yeah. That is correct. But I just like Fred. Fred is better. You just call it Fred. It makes all the nerds happy.
That's right.
Fred is our friend. Anyway, looking at the data for housing starts, and I can zoom in and zoom out on this data. There's a lot of cool tools available. In January of 2006, and let me say, well, first, what is a housing start? And why is this the answer to irrational exuberance? I haven't forgotten the question. Housing starts are one of the leading indicators of really big money hitting the system in the future. So a housing start is when someone says, I'm beginning the process of getting a mortgage, or we're beginning the construction process for a new house. So this is literally a start, not a new purchase, an actual new house. That has a magnified effect on the economy. It's one of the largest influencers of growth into the future. And in January of 2006, that number peaked out at 2,273. 2,273 is a big number. And I realize it's kind of like an index number. People say, what does that mean? It's kind of like saying, what does the Dow mean? It's an index based on future growth. Okay. So 2,273, we had a drop down into May of 2009. So the depths of the biggest recession of most of the people listening's lifetime was 478. So when we look up at the 2000 numbers, we're talking about 2000 extra, down to about 478. We have come nowhere near that level of housing starts since then. Nowhere. I mean, we're half of that now at the at a pretty high point. We're at 1,300 now. We're half of the peak of what I consider to be truly irrational exuberance on the housing start side, where people were just saying, I'm going to create houses everywhere. And they did. And then we had a glut in the system that we're still dealing with. So we're not having a huge demand for new houses. That's part of what drives the rest of the economy. The stock market has these unicorns, and the unicorns, a lot of them I would consider to be irrationally overvalued, but there aren't that many of them compared to the rest of the market.
I think it's too early for irrational exuberance.
Yeah, I agree.
Actually, what we saw during the year is retail investors leaving equity mutual funds and going to bond funds during the year, and that's not an indication of irrational exuberance.
Yeah.
We've reached the upper limits of normal for the stock market.
I think people are optimistic but not exuberant at this point.
If we get a trade deal and everybody gets all excited at the beginning of next year about all the good things that are happening, that's typically when the irrational exuberance, and that's something
to
watch out for.
There's still a lot of people that are nervous and scared right now.
Yeah.
You need enough good news and enough people saying, hey, drink this Kool-Aid with me.
But again, paralleling this, and we have a caller on 773-1400. Hang on just a second. Paralleling this, if we're looking at the model going back to 1999 and 2000, which we seem to be following, at this point in 1999, employment was at a record high, unemployment was at a near record low, market was at the top end of what we would consider to be a normal valuation. By the way, at almost exactly the same price earnings ratio we see today, 26.8, I think it is. Based on this year's earnings, not future earnings. And nobody saw a recession coming. No, I mean, there was a very low probability by the estimates of a recession when we look at the end of 2006 or when we end 1999. But by the end of 2007, in other words, in the last quarter of 2007 is when the recession started. The last quarter of 2000 is when the recession started. That's almost a year from now. And so we're repeating this pattern very nicely, and we're seeing confidence rise. We've got Jeff Gundlach, who said there was a 50-50 chance of a recession a couple of months ago, and then he said there's a 35% chance of a recession, and apparently he came out Friday and said there's practically no chance of a recession. As odd as that sounds, he's very good at predicting these things, but the fact that he said there's little chance of a recession indicates that there's a higher probability of recession.
Yeah.
And we have a
when the experts start saying don't worry about it, that's the point where you really actually need to start worrying about it.
And we do have a caller on 773-1400.
Caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. You know, this town, I've been noticing there's been a lot of new developments coming up, and they're building a lot of houses. The only thing I don't understand about this is why are all these houses look identically alike? You know, if I was going to buy a house, why would I want somebody to have the same floor plan, everything like my house, and then they make a mistake and try to enter my house, and then they get shot and killed? I don't understand that. You have a debate.
All right.
Well, it is getting shot and killed entering the house. That is kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little houses on the, little boxes on the hillside.
Well,
little boxes.
We do
ticky-tacky.
We have a problem in the United States, and that's a lack of affordable housing. And that is an area where there's a lot of people who want to buy houses but can't afford them.
Right.
And so builders are responding to that need in this area particularly by building a lot of houses inexpensively, and by definition, redesigning every house to not look like your neighbor's house is very expensive.
Yeah, that's where expenses come
in. And if you build them so they're all pretty much the same kind of house, it's very inexpensive,
cheap.
And people can buy houses. And that's why they're building houses that look alike, because they can build them less expensively.
Right. That may change when the robots are doing all the construction, but it probably won't.
No.
It probably won't. You'll
program
get
the robots
model.
One time, or maybe every fourth house will look the same.
Yeah, and that's really it, is that this is not a new phenomena. When a big development is going on, they maybe have five or six models of house, but if they're aiming at a certain price range, they're not going to have a whole lot of choice between house models.
And the other thing is, caller, I suspect you're a baby boomer. Baby boomers want everything to look different than their neighbor. But that's not necessarily true of millennials, and it's not necessarily, well, it is to some degree true of,
bless
excuse
you.
Me, the X generation. But there is, in younger people today, there is not so much a need to have their house look, quote, unique, end quote. As a matter of fact, they're used to living in apartments, and the apartments are by definition all the same.
Which is kind of just a side note. I'm going to be a word nerd for a second. Why do you think when you put a bunch of living establishments really close together that you would call them apartments?
Well, because they're not all living in a communal living
in a, like
open
a
space.
Auditorium?
So they make
go live in your auditorium.
They separate them into parts.
It's apart from each other, though.
Yeah.
They're really stuck together.
Yeah,
they should be called stuck togetherments.
Yeah, well, maybe for you, but not.
Yeah,
really.
I'm a word nerd. I'm telling you. I think it'll be the newest word craze if we all start saying it's a stuck togetherment.
Well, I've noticed a word change in this area that I think is pretty fascinating. The X generation, who are getting a little older now.
Well, everybody's getting a little older,
well,
unless they're dead.
They're not the young, fresh generation they were a few years ago.
No.
And they don't live in apartments.
Nope.
They live in condos that look just like apartments.
Yes.
But they call them condos.
But they are condos.
And they don't own them. They just pay rent on them. But they pay rent on a condo.
Some of them. I mean, you look at the statistics. There's a big number of them doing that. But there's all the Xers are also buying a lot of houses
at this point. But the ones who are living in apartments are not calling them apartments anymore. They're calling them condos. If they market to that group of people, they call them condos. However, the millennials are perfectly happy to live in apartments.
Nope.
They're not.
The statistic says that they would much rather be owning at this point.
No, I mean, they don't. It's an apartment, whether you call it a condo or an apartment.
Right.
If you're renting
it,
it's an apartment.
Yeah.
But the point is, the millennials don't have any objection to calling it apartments because they consider it temporary.
And here's something that I think is the offshoot of that question. And this is something we've touched on a couple of times in the past over the last several months. But at some point, the baby boomers want to downsize. And that's something we're seeing
in the
statistics. Right now, the people that are buying the houses that they're selling so they can downsize are other baby boomers that are still upsizing. But their long-term projection is also to downsize. At some point, who's going to be there to buy?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing in the statistics right now. And the numbers are, they tell stories. We're seeing this, you know, this huge, we were just talking about the housing start before the 2007, 2008, 2009 drop in housing starts. And that was the baby boomers buying their retirement homes. And that led into a frenzy of everybody jumping into the housing industry because the baby boomers were buying their retirement homes. At some point, they're going to sell those homes. And it's probably not going to be in the same beginning, in the same kind of volume. But at some point, we're going to get the same kind of a lot of people trying to sell at the same time in the bigger houses. When I'm looking at the numbers right now, it's showing that housing sales have dropped, but the upper-end housing prices have continued to rise. So
well,
think
that
about
sense.
That.
There's an absence of supply, and the demand is still there.
Well,
so the price goes up.
But the sales have dropped.
Now,
the demand is not as high.
No, the sales have dropped because there's so few houses for sale. If you look at the number of days a house stays on the market nationwide right now,
it's
approaching a record low.
Well, yeah, I would say 5 months, but it's not as low as it was, say, 4 years ago. 4 years ago, we didn't have the kind of building boom that we've got going on now, and that's the thing, is we're approaching the same level we were 4 years ago.
If you just look at the upper-end houses, the ones you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They stay on the market for days.
in some
much.
Places. And that's not true on the West Coast anymore.
It's not true on the West Coast, but across the country.
And that was the leading place where this was going on, where they were staying. They were just getting snapped up right away. They're not anymore.
The point is that if you look at it nationwide, the higher the value of the house, up to a certain point, until you get into the rarefied movie star houses, the higher the upper value houses, the ones that the baby boomers are swapping back and forth, are generally only staying on the market for a few days. And the lower you run down the scale, the longer they stay on the market until you finally drop down to the affordable housing like the ones that they're building now, which immediately gets scarfed up as soon as they're built.
Right.
So you've got the baby boomers swapping houses pretty enthusiastically, but there's a big point, and the Wall Street Journal had an article on this. There's about 22.3 million houses that belong to baby boomers where the baby boomers have said they are eventually going to move out of that house and sell it, and I suspect they'll all do it at the same time, or pretty much all of them will do it at the same time. And as they do it, you're going to see the price of those houses come down rather dramatically, and some very, very, very unhappy boomers when they discover they can't sell their houses. Because, very frankly, a big baby boomer house is not too attractive to an Xer. This is nothing
right.
new. This is nothing new. I mean, you look in Austin, and you look at the houses that were the thing to have in Hyde Park and so on years ago, many decades ago. And their price dropped at some point, and now when people want to move in, the house is completely out of style, and they have to either rebuild the entire house, or in many cases, they just level the house and start all over again. But the style of houses is changing, and there will come a time when the baby boomers, and this is one of the things that when the baby boomers start leaving everything, and when they do, that's going to attract a lot of attention. And it's going to be a pretty significant event, and
right.
we're coming up on it.
The population won't shrink at that point. That's something people think, you know, we're going to have a drop in population. No, it won't shrink. We've grown well above so that bulge. We have a growing population, even if the baby boomers are dying. It's just going to be at a slower growth rate. As they go away, it's going to cause a big drag, though. As they leave the workforce, it's going to cause a drag on the economy. And we're starting to see some of that because they've been doing this a long time. They're good at it.
And they're good at, and they're still living in their big houses.
Yeah.
And they haven't started leaving them yet. But once they start leaving those houses and they hit the market, there'll be a lot of them hit the market in a relatively short period of time. Now, when that's going to happen? Roughly 10 years from now is supposedly the big impact, from what I've read, but we'll see how it works out. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we didn't talk very much about the market. It was up 0.73%. It was actually negative for most of the week.
For the week, it was up just a little bit,
but it was
a record.
It was mostly negative until the China-U.S. trade deal was announced, and then it came back up and broke some records on Thursday. And then it started sagging back again on Friday. And why did it sag back again on Friday? Once the deal, we don't have all the details on the China-U.S. trade agreement yet. But as they've come out, they're not as big a thing as we thought they were. It's more like a China-U.S. trade truce.
Right. It's a ceasefire. It's not even a truce. It's more like a ceasefire because we're keeping a lot of the tariffs in place.
We have 25% tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports that were imposed this year that are staying in place. And
we're cutting in half some of the tariffs. We're removing
about $120 billion
right.
worth. We're cutting half. And then
and
we
we're
didn't
not
do the
doing,
15%.
Yeah, the today's new tariffs were supposed to kick in at another group. And so that didn't happen.
And so it's the absence of some bad news is the nature, the absence of some bad news is the nature of this agreement as we've heard it so far. But again, this is something that's very important. The Chinese are announcing details of this trade agreement that the U.S. is not announcing. And we've in the past discovered that when one side announces and the other side doesn't completely agree with it, that sometimes it's not that way. So there's still some uncertainty out there. And that's why you're not seeing too much excitement about it. It's like the USMCA trade agreement for some reason, and I haven't completely understood this, the Republicans in the Senate are upset about it.
I can tell you why.
And it's theoretically because the trade representative was talking to the Democrats in the House too
right.
much.
Well, the Democrats in the House have tacked a couple of things in there. And the Republicans in the Senate wanted it just left as it was, no changes at all.
But the Republicans in the House theoretically have supported it.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason is because they wanted to get it to the Senate. Right now this is funny. You get into politics and it's like political or something. It's about popularity, and right now it's not a good time to agree with anything that the House is doing in the Senate for some reason. If you're a Republican in the Senate, you don't want to agree with anybody in the House right now because there's other things happening in the House that might cause political consequences. Some minor event
but
happening.
Theoretically, at least according to the leaders in the Senate, it may very well be February before the Senate gets around to taking up consideration of the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
Right. Well, when you think that they may have the rest of December full with that other minor event that's happening.
Actually, January is when the Senate is going to take up impeachment.
They had said in the past they were going to try to do it in December.
Yeah,
if they take it up in January, that tells you why they're pushing off other events. And that it, what we're talking about, we tried to stay out of the political side of things, which is pure politics instead of economics with some politics flavor. But the impeachment is going on right now. And that is something that is impacting consideration of other bills, to say mildly.
And so there's a lot of things going on, a lot of things moving all at the same time.
We didn't have a government shutdown. We haven't had a government shutdown yet.
We've only got the
preliminary.
We've only got the leaders of both parties saying that we've reached an agreement on how to avoid a government shutdown, but we got to work out the details. And the devil is in the details. But folks, this is one of those things that's not making headlines. But on the 20th of this month, the end of fall, the beginning of winter.
6 days from now.
The government
next
is
Friday.
Scheduled to shut down unless we get a budget agreement. And the budget agreement has been conceptually arrived at by the leaders of the parties, but
politicians don't change their mind after they announce. Wait, yes,
the details have not been worked out, and whether there'll be a majority in the House to support it is questionable at this point. And this is one of those things that everybody is assuming is going to work out just fine, so let's not worry about it. Those are the things that ultimately in my now 40 years thereabout of experience in viewing the economy and the markets, one of the things that I have noted very consistently is it's not the things you're scared of that bite you. It's not the things you're worrying about and people are devoting a lot of headlines to. It's the things that, oh, there's no need to worry about that. One of those things is what rises up and bites us every time.
There's a great story associated with that I heard in deer hunting camp when I was a child in Oklahoma with your family. And that was the story about the man who saw the snake in the grass,
yeah.
And he reached down and picked up a stick to smack the snake. And it turned out that the snake that he saw in the grass was really a stick. But the stick that he reached to grab to hit the snake with was really a snake.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, in the market, that's the normal.
Yeah, but
we're afraid of something, and so we're extra prepared. It's like planning for the last war. We're extra prepared for that thing, but that's not what gets us.
The moral of that story you heard in deer camp is if you see a snake in the grass, just leave him alone.
that's kind of the big thing. just leave it alone.
Just leave it alone because, by the way, that is an interesting statistic. The vast majority, and I'm talking about 90-some percent of the people in the United States bit by snakes, were interacting with the snake before they got bit. In other words, they were trying to kill it, or they were trying to pick it up, or they were trying to capture it or something. Snake bites that occur by accident where you weren't doing anything intentionally to a snake
are
extremely rare. So the moral to that story is very simply, if you see a snake, leave it alone.
Admire it from a distance.
Anyway, the the Treasury interest rates basically followed the market. They bounced up on the U.S. on the concept of a China-U.S. trade deal, and then when the details came out, they sagged back again. They rose just a little bit, but not enough to get too excited about. 4.5 basis points, closing at 1.827. Now, don't get irrationally exuberant about things are getting, everything is going just fine. Let me tell you why. A year ago, that 10-year treasury was up near 3%. It was right around 3%, and it's at 1.8% now. The higher the 10-year treasury is, the higher the interest rates on the 10-year treasury, the better the bond market participants think the economy is going to be 10 years from now. And right now, at a 1.8% interest rate, they're saying there won't be much inflation, there won't be much growth, there won't be much of anything occur over the next several years. As a matter of fact, if you go back down to 5 years where it's around 1.5, 1.6%, that is lower than inflation. And if you're willing to loan money to the government at a rate lower than inflation is running right now, that's an indication that you think a recession is coming. So the conclusion, if you looked at the bond market, and that's one of the best predictors out there of what's happening in the future, and you take a long look at it, you realize that the consensus of the people who have a lot of money to loan is that things are not going to be too good in the next couple of years.
Right.
And that hasn't changed. Now, if you see the interest rates come up dramatically, that would be a mess to begin with because there's so many zombie companies out there right now that are dependent upon lower interest rates.
Yeah.
But the bond market is still forecasting some muted or unpleasant economic results in the next couple of years.
Yeah. And we've got to play some commercials. I'd like to talk more about that subject when we come back. But we got to play the commercials. It will be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You didn't say McClure.
I didn't. I was pushing buttons. We have a caller waiting for us, hopefully waiting for us, on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. Thanks for talking to us today. You're talking about the Treasury, but can you guys kind of talk to us about the repo? Is this a really serious thing or, kind of like the housing crisis, something that... it's been building and then suddenly exploded on us. Is this serious or is this just a...
good question.
Very good question. You're obviously paying attention.
Yeah, and that's actually when I said I wanted to talk more about this subject after the break. This is exactly what I wanted to talk about. So thanks for the call. Right. We're gonna go into some detail. Appreciate it. And are you okay hanging up and listening? It sounds like you already did. Okay.
Yeah, that the repo, in there was another $56 billion, I think, on Friday. The New York Fed injected into the system. And the other thing is, and you can get the details, but I want the New York Fed just basically overhauled its executives and got rid of all of its old executives and hired a bunch of, and actually promoted from internally promoted a bunch of new ones. It's doing a major overhaul of the way it handles the money market system in New York, and there's a lot there. There's actually several explanations, and Jake is probably more conversant with one of them than I am, and I'm gonna let him talk about that. But the point is, there's a lot we don't know. We can make a story and say here's why this is happening, but this is something new. This is something that previously has only occurred at the very bottom, like in 2009 or in 2002, at the bottom of a crisis. And here we are, we're not having a financial crisis in the United States, but we are having the Federal Reserve have to step in and do what previously banks were doing because the system locked up and ran interest rates up to high levels suddenly.
Right. So we're going to start by talking to people that don't know what we're talking about. The repo, it's not repossessing a car or being repoed. The repo market is a cash market that banks use to loan each other assets overnight. So, or very, very short. Usually it's overnight. Sometimes it's two nights. It's very, very short loans. And they will generally put up some collateral. So they'll say, here, you hold this and I'll grab it tomorrow and give you your money back. That's the repo. I'll repossess it after you've got it. I repossess it tomorrow. Give me an overnight line. Well, why would a bank need to do that? Well, a bank needs. It allows you to maintain. If you're not capable of growing from the bottom, of emphasizing the growth, of concentrating on the areas that are growing, then it's going to take longer to pull yourself out. And if you're not concentrating on where the friction is heating up, where the fractures are starting, you won't know how to adjust to maintain the growth longer. What the Federal Reserve is doing is allowing that growth to maintain for a while, and hopefully they'll have some more permanent solution to this and just making their rules up. And we're about out of time for this hour.
And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do have local offices, and we are the Personal Wealth Coach, a wealth management firm, independent investment advisory, fee only, and can't say fee only.
Yes. You have less than $100 or around $100 that comes in a month from that we give to charity from commissions as an insurance agent 30 years ago.
Oh.
Okay. So we're not allowed to say fee only.
Okay. We're not fee only.
We are fee based.
Right. We're fee based. We're independent fiduciaries. And if you give us a call at 254-947-1111 or
1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to the radio recordings or send us information. Until next